But when I talk with the folks on the tech side of things, they'll often be very optimistic about mind uploads because they want to continue living and they think death is bad and they have their own eschatology in a tech space. It's fascinating, actually. But then when pressed, they do go back to like Derek Parfitian structuralist view or patternist view of mind. And you go, well, wait, that's not actually you. And they go, oh, yeah, no, it's not actually me. And say, but your whole impetus here was that you wanted to continue living. And then when I press you on it, you're not actually living. And actually, yeah. You're not living now. It's just the pattern. And you are a strange loop. And, you know, it's really fascinating and fun to have this
kind of a bait and switch, I think. When they're pitching the idea, they say it's really you. But when they're justifying the technology, they say, nah, it's not really you.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest questions in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is very, very special. I have with me Ralph Weir, and we're going to be talking about his fantastic new book, The Mind-Body Problem and Metaphysics, An Argument from Consciousness to Mental Substance. If you guys know anything about this show, you know this is right in my curiosity wheelhouse. I love consciousness and I love substance dualism. Sometimes I get lured into science of consciousness type stuff. This is where it's at. This is what I love so much. So this is the philosophy of consciousness and metaphysics and whether or not you are a mental substance or a holistic unity, a psychosomatic unity, as my theologian friends insist on saying. Though they're not clear on whether or not that is entails substance dualism. So we're going to get into all sorts of good stuff here today. Primarily, why is property dualism, the view that there are properties, but no immaterial properties, but no immaterial substances, why is that so preferable to substance dualism? And why Dr. Ralph Weir thinks if you go in for property dualism, then you're on the hook for substance dualism. So we're going to get into it. I'm really excited. Before we jump in, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen over on Patreon or YouTube members. If you guys like the show, if you want to continue to see me bring on world's experts in philosophy, theology, nature, and life, then please consider supporting the podcast. You can find that link to Patreon in the description, wherever you're getting this podcast at. Or if you prefer YouTube members, you can find the join button if you're watching here on YouTube. That is huge. If you're listening on Spotify, you can also get these episodes ad-free now. So check that out, subscribe, whatever. Everything has different things. You follow and you subscribe and whatever. On Spotify, you subscribe for $4.99 a month and you get ad-free listening. So check that out. All right, that's a lot of commodification. So let's just jump into some deep philosophy of mind. Ralph, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a great honor.
This book is fantastic. I'm really excited. In the book, I think you coined this term, psychophobic. We live in a psychophobic age. People who are afraid of the psuche, the psyche, the soul, or the immaterial mind. So with that in mind, how did you get into studying substance dualism in such a psychophobic age?
Thanks. It's an interesting question. As a teenager, I guess I had a sort of fairly standard materialist kind of new atheist leaning view of reality. I went to study philosophy as an undergrad, finding big questions generally very interesting. And I had this experience of studying philosophy of mind as an undergraduate. And the whole time I felt like I was being kind of almost gaslighted, like all of the main views, as far as I could tell, were either some kind of eliminative or reductive materialism or some kind of Wittgensteinian quietism about the fact that in addition to our physical bodies, we have this, resplendent phenomenology going on in our minds all the time. And I couldn't quite believe anyone, not only took these views very seriously, but didn't even give any attention to the alternative views that had dominated, so far as I could tell, for most of history, according to which there's some very fundamental extra thing present, the soul, the mind, or whatever it is. And I actually found that very off-putting. I was kind of a bit fed up with philosophy, but I persevered to graduate level and I went to some lectures by Stephen Priest and Roger Scruton over at Oxford, in which both in different ways took very seriously the traditional idea of a soul. Scruton's lecture was called something like Neuroscience and the Soul. I think he wanted to call it Neuro-nonsense and the Soul, but they wouldn't let him. They thought it was too offensive to science. And Steve Priest's lectures were called Philosophical Questions, Theological Answers. That made me realize, oh, well, maybe you're allowed to take this stuff seriously. And from then on, I decided, right, I'm gonna try and crack this problem. We'll try and give substance dualism, or the idea of the soul, a fair intellectual hearing.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That's fantastic. That sounds like Scruton. I really love Roger Scruton, Sir Roger Scruton. And sometimes I get slack from that from American graduate students who are like, Roger Scruton, not a serious. And it's like, man, if you read some of this, he's a pretty serious thinker. I'd love to ask you about that later, but he's got this like cognitive dualism that I can't really understand that I think might be property dualism, but we can go on to that later. I wanted to ask, what'd you do I don't know. It's probably not a dissertation over there. It's probably a thesis. But what'd you do that in? And then can you fill us in? Where'd you go from there? Where are you doing your work at right now?
So I did my when I met Stephen Priest and Roger Scruton, that was as a graduate master student, and I wrote a BPhil thesis at Oxford on the interaction problem in particular. Then I did my PhD at Cambridge with Tim Crane, and that was essentially the foundation for the book, The Mind-Body Problem and Metaphysics. I think the PhD is called Metaphysics and the Mind-Body Problem. I could never remember which way around I intended those to go. The PhD, it's almost the same text, except it has a bunch of ultra technical chapters setting things up at the start, which Dean Zimmerman advised me to just cut out and get to the more interesting stuff. And then whilst I was writing that, I started working at the University of Lincoln, which is a very, very young university in the East Midlands in England. It's kind of maybe 20 years old. And very excitingly, they decided to start a new philosophy faculty there. And I was lucky enough to be one of two or three people right in at the beginning. And now I'm a permanent member of faculty there, although at the moment on research leave for a year, currently a visiting researcher at the University of Warsaw.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Yeah, I didn't know they were allowed to have new universities. Everything there is like hundreds and hundreds of years old. That's so cool. So Tim Crane, was Dean Zimmerman on your committee as well?
Dean Zimmerman was on my examination. He was my external examiner.
Awesome. Two of my favorite Parker Pensey's guests. If you guys are hearing that and want to go check those out, maybe I'll drop some links in the description to them as well. That's so cool. This is so fascinating. You piqued my interest by talking about non-material things. Usually we only talk about like the mind in a lot of these conversations, but you brought up Leibnizian monads, Aristotelian intellects, and Cartesian souls or minds, Cartesian minds, I believe. Do you think Leibnizian monads, like, would you count that as being a form of substance dualism, and likewise with Aristotelian intellects? Do those count?
Yeah. It's a great question. So, starting with Leibnizian monads, I think Leibniz's idea of monad is roughly the idea of an immaterial mental substance. He has some pretty idiosyncratic things to say about what it means for something to be a substance, and there are some complications to get into that. I wouldn't call Leibniz a substance dualist because on his official view, as I understand it, he thinks there are only monads, and therefore he's really an idealist. I actually think Leibniz is fairly straightforwardly an earlier Russellian monist. Really, we should say Russell's a Leibnizian monist.
That's right.
He'd read Leibniz. He knew about this stuff. But the book and my own interests are principally geared towards reviving the idea of an immaterial substance or soul. And so idealism or substance dualism are both compatible with that. As for the case of Aristotle, it's, of course, highly complex and hotly contested. My own opinion is it's completely clear, or as clear as one could ask, as clear as Aristotle ever is, that he thinks that the intellect is an immaterial substance, at least in the sense that it's definitely immaterial, and it can survive without a physical body. So he clearly makes room for that in De Anima, and he seems to talk about it explicitly in the Metaphysics. And most ancient interpreters of Aristotle just took it for granted that that was his view. It's importantly distinct in its details from Plato's view, but nonetheless continuous with it. And that's definitely true of later Aristotelians, Aquinas, and so on. A lot of Aristotelians take issue with that interpretation. I think that's because they're influenced by contemporary psychophobia. They don't like the idea that this guy they admire thinks there's an immaterial, substantial mind or soul or intellect. My opinion is that actually Aristotle is like most influential historical thinkers on my side on this issue.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I think maybe we could talk. I want to keep dropping pins because I want to introduce the audience to the main themes, but I'd love to talk about like personhood and whether that follows the Aristotelian intellect or not. But first and foremost, I mean, the book is called The Mind-Body Problem in Metaphysics. Can you broach that for us? What is the mind-body problem in your mind?
Absolutely. Yeah. The way I usually introduce it and the way I introduce it in the book is that as a human being, you have a bunch of physical properties like any physical object, like a rock. You have shape and size and weight and so on. You also have some more complex properties involving moving parts like respiration, digestion, a bit like a more complex physical object like a clock or even a computer. But then in addition to those properties, you also have these are mental properties. So you have thoughts, feelings, experiences, desires, beliefs, and most startlingly of all, as Thomas Nagel points out in his great essay, What It's Like to Be a Bat, there's something it's like to be you from the inside, right? You have this interior, this first-person perspective on the world with an sort of an internal phenomenology filled with shapes and colors and flashing lights and all the rest of it. And the mind-body problem, as I understand it, is the problem of explaining, well, what's going on here? Why is it that in some respects, you're just like any other physical thing, but in other respects, you are fundamentally and radically different, or you seem to be fundamentally and radically different. And I see the idea of soul-body dualism as kind of, for most of history and most times and places in most cultures around the globe, as the leading response to this problem.
Yeah. So the way I'm thinking of it after reading your book and just after studying philosophy of mind and stuff, it to me it's like there's a large problem, the mind-body problem, and then that will be raised for different philosophies of mind based on their own distinctives. So like the maybe for the substance dualist, people always will say, well, what about interaction, you know, the pineal gland? And then for the physicalist, they say, well, it's the hard problem, or the hardest problem, or the meta hard problem. Do you think that the mind, does that make sense? Does that sound right? Or is the hard problem different than the mind body problem in important ways?
I mean, obviously there are no rules written in the sky about how we use this terminology. And when people are assuming the answer we're trying to defend is physicalism, then the mind body problem is the hard problem of consciousness. That's the part, the aspect of it that becomes difficult. If we're assuming we're trying to defend dualism, then the hard part is the interaction problem, or putatively, that's the hard part. I think people sometimes use the term in a narrower sense. In the book, I mean the broad problem of just explaining what's going on. Why is it that human beings have these radically different kinds of properties?
Yeah, okay. So obviously you think this is important. You spent so much time working on it with some of the world's leading scholars, and you become one yourself. I love this problem. I love philosophy of mind. And I'm tempted to say, like, this is the core problem of philosophy. Where do you think this fits in importance to the whole of philosophy, I guess?
Yeah. My opinion is that it is absolutely central. I think a lot of the leading historical philosophers, both in the Western tradition and in non-Western traditions, have recognized that. If you look at Plato, or if you look at the classical texts of Hindu philosophy or Jain philosophy, you find really central is the problem of the self. And I think there are two respects in which it's particularly important today. One of these is that my opinion is, roughly speaking, something like this. For most of the history of philosophy, you had this fairly consistent view of human nature as involving these two different aspects, material and immaterial, and also in some sense worldly and spiritual. And although you always had a kind of contrary view put forward by the Epicureans in the West, or the Chavatska school in India, according to which actually it's all just material, that was always a minority position. But I think that for the first time in the whole history of the world, we live in the modern West, an Epicurean age where people endorse this materialist view about human nature, which also has all sorts of consequences for our understanding of our place in the wider cosmos and the wider cosmos itself. So I think it's particularly important in our day for that reason. There's been a historical shift in the dominant position. And then secondly, I think that shift is bound up with the second reason for thinking the mind-body problem is especially important today, which is what we should make philosophically of the description of the world given to us by natural science. Natural science, completely brilliant, fascinating accomplishment of humanity, but one which gives us a vision of the cosmos many people want to treat as exhaustive, in a sense that entails there can be no immaterial soul, there can be no absolute moral values, and so on, for all sorts of other stuff that many people have historically and even today think are important. So I think it's pretty central. One final thing I'd say on that is, my own suspicion is that the answer you give to the mind-body problem is going to make a big difference to your view of everything else.
Yeah.
If you're a materialist about that, you're likely to be, broadly speaking, Epicurean about the rest of the cosmos. You'll think it's basically particles bouncing around in the void. Moral values are a matter of preference, and so on. If you think there's some fundamental self or soul or whatever, it's going to radically change how you reason about everything else.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And maybe it's an empirical question. I'm sure it probably is, but even when it comes to the rest of your philosophy and whether or not you go in for like a naturalized epistemology or, you know, certain things, I've just seen a correlation, I guess, between being if you hold to some form of dualism, especially substance dualism, and the rest of your philosophy. And a lot of times I can guess what you believe in other fields based on what you believe about the mind, which is fun. Not always. People like to mix and match, for sure. That's cool. I've noticed that in theological circles, there's this huge trend away from Descartes and, you know, we're not brains on sticks, we're psychosomatic unities, and being a substance dualist over there was kind of passé. And then getting over into the philosophy world, still kind of passé, but at least they'll take you a little bit more serious because of Chalmers or someone. And then moving into like the cognitive science world, a lot of people are just like really intrigued by it. They think everything's computation anyways, but they're like, oh, you actually believe that stuff? Oh, you, and I'm a Christian as well. So they're like, oh, you believe in theology? Tell me about that. So it's so funny where the audience has moved to wanting to hear about this stuff. I think it's hilarious.
Yeah, I think it's a nice thing about defending the idea of the soul is that it's a really ecumenical position to take, because everyone's going to hate you, whether they're like Christian theologians, or whether they're natural scientists, or they're clearly proponents of multiple otherwise highly divergent schools in philosophy, Wittgensteinism, deconstruction, Quinean naturalism, and so on. It's something that all these intellectual trends are united in resisting. I think it's an interesting feature of our age. I suspect it revealed something very deep about the time we live in. I'm not quite sure what.
Yeah, totally. Well, so I wanted to bring that up just to mention that chapters 1 and 2, one is why does everyone hate the soul? 2 is the decline of substance dualism and the substance property distinction. It's really helpful, like historical consideration, while also, you know, putting your finger on really important points as a analytic philosopher, I'd say. So I really commend those. I really like those. I didn't want to spend a whole bunch of time on those because I think we could do like 2 episodes on each one of those. So I just commend the book that you guys need to grab this book and you need to read 1 and 2 to see like the why of how we got here or potentially why we got here. But I took it that the key premise of the book is that, you know, if you posit non-physical properties, then you should be prepared to posit non-physical substances as well. Okay, so if you go in for non-physical properties, you may be on the hook, or you should at least be prepared to be on the hook for a non-physical substance. And so with that in mind, I thought it would be helpful to get some definitions of like property, substance, property dualism, and substance dualism. I know that's like a huge, that's like chapters in this book, but if we can just give a characterization, maybe.
And it's a great thing to talk about. I mean, I would what I'd really like is people to read chapter 1 of this book. I think if they read chapter 1, then they'll see the sort of the big picture I'm coming from. They might not think I'm so crazy. Or at least they'll see that. The reason I called it the mind-body problem and metaphysics is because I have this sense that the really serious discussion in analytical philosophy about these positions has been held back by the fact that the people doing philosophy of mind, working on the mind-body problem, tend not to be doing serious, precise metaphysics, where we're trying to make it really clear, well, what do we mean by a property? What do we mean by a substance? And if you don't do that, you're not going to be able to give a precise reason for wanting to only posit non-physical properties, not non-physical substances. Now, I think that's been convenient, arguably, for people like Kimmel, Jackson, and so on, because they want to sell their version of dualism as essentially naturalistic. It's not bringing back Descartes or Plato or anything like that. And so it's useful for them to say, no, it's only property dualism, and not to have to give a clear explanation of what exactly that involves. Mm-hmm. So early-ish in the book, I make an effort at distinguishing, well, what exactly do we mean by these terms? And it gets a little complex because the nature of properties is bound up with the problem of universals. There are actually like 5 standard views of properties. But I think we can skip over that and say, the really crucial thing that traditional proponents of dualism assert, and that even contemporary dualists like Chalmers, Kim, Jackson, at least typically want to deny, I think Chalmers is actually a bit more liberal on this, is that there is an immaterial something involved in our human nature that accounts for our mental properties, which could exist separately from the body. And there does exist this traditional conception of substance, where the word substance is not like what we mean by substance in ordinary colloquial English, where we just mean stuff. The word substance means, roughly speaking, something that could exist separately or that could exist by itself. That some people think this was Aristotle's definition of substance way back in the Categories. He's a little ambiguous. But certainly by the time of Descartes, I think it's perfectly clear that that's what a substance means. So on the terminology I use in the book, a substance is just something that could exist separately from other things. And a property is just anything that couldn't. So if you take, for example, the shape of my wine glass here, the wine glass can exist without the wine bottle. There's a bottle too. But the shape of the wine glass can't exist without the rest of the wine glass. We can't take the shape and put it over here and keep the size and the density and everything else about the wine glass over here. That's symptomatic of the fact that the shape of the wine glass is a property of it. So according to the terminology I think is useful, if you think that there are non-physical aspects to human nature that we need to posit to account for conscious experience, if you think there are qualia or phenomenal properties, as people sometimes call them, the property of what it's like to experience a color or a pain, but you deny that there is any immaterial aspect or part of the human person that can exist by itself without their body, then you count as a property dualist. Whereas if you take the view that there is some part or aspect of human nature that we need to posit, solve the mind-body problem that could in principle exist by itself without the body, then you're a substance dualist. And if you think there's only that immaterial thing and nothing material, ultimately, then you're an idealist. That's how I use these terms.
That's so good. And so on this understanding, a property would include like properties, qualities, and attributes. Like it's just a catch-all for all those things,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's a really broad term as I use it. I think most philosophers do use property interchangeably with attribute, quality, and so on. You might think like there's two kinds of properties. There's qualities and quantities. Aristotle has this whole complex schema. I just use it for any feature of a thing that can't exist without the thing it belongs to.
That's so helpful, because it I'll read different subdisciplines in philosophy, and they're talking about secondary qualities. And I'm like, man, I just spent all this time reading about properties. Can we just, let's just call it this? And I just,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I understand. Someone who's done a lot of work on that would say, no, we need the distinction. So I understand. So Aristotle, you bring up Aristotle, Descartes, and Locke. And Locke kind of introduces substratum, and
yeah.
And that may be closer to what Aristotle meant by like prime matter or a bare particular. It's like this thing without any properties. And
yeah.
Then I think you said in the book, I'm pretty sure this was like your view that Descartes didn't go in for any kind of substratum or any kind of bare particular, but that he was more of a bundle theorist.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's crazy to me, because it seems like he needs something underneath there holding those all together. But I took it that you agreed with him over against Locke. Is that right? Or
two things have really helped to confuse debates involving the idea of substance in modern philosophy. The first of these is the suggestion initially put forward, I think, by Leibniz, that if a substance is something that can exist by itself, then it must be able to exist without its own properties. And that sounds incoherent. What would it mean for something to exist without any properties? What kind of something would it be? Therefore, this definition of substance makes no sense. And then there's a related, but I think distinct, confusion arising out of Locke's suggestion that by the word substance, we mean something that stands under, he uses the Latin etymology, stands under the properties of a thing and kind of holds them all together. Now, since you asked about Locke, I'll talk about that. It is simply false that that's what the word substance had traditionally meant when Locke wrote that. It's just not true that when Aristotle or Descartes talk about substances, they mean these mysterious, propertyless entities. Rather, they give examples. They mean things like human beings or horses or minds or bodies, things that have properties. Now, and so when we talk about substance dualism, we should be, at least if we are inclined, at least if we think that the terminology should be continuous with Descartes as the paradigm substance dualist, then we should be wary of assuming that Locke is telling us what substance means in this context. A lot of people haven't done that, and they've assumed that a substance dualist has to be someone who thinks there's this mysterious, propertyless thing that underlies the mind rather than that there's just an immaterial thing that can exist separately. Now, you said it sounds crazy to you that Descartes is a kind of bundle theorist. I'd say a couple of things about that. One important clarification is that people use the term bundle theory in two slightly different ways. Sometimes when they talk about a bundle theorist, they mean someone who thinks that any substance in the traditional sense, which means roughly an object that can exist separately, like a wine glass, but not like the size of a wine glass, any substance is a bundle of properties in the sense that those properties are more fundamental than it and could exist separately from it. It's kind of a swarm of properties.
Would you say now, that's Hume? Would Hume be represented by that? Okay.
So Hume's idea that the mind is a bundle of perceptions is rightly described as a bundle theory in that sense. Hume actually thinks those individual perceptions could all exist separately from one another. He's very explicit about this. And he's actually quite clear. He says, and therefore, in Descartes' sense of the term, they are substances. Well, he doesn't say Descartes, but in the sense that he definitely takes from Descartes, things that can exist by themselves, they're substances. Now, Descartes definitely isn't a bundle theorist about substances in that sense. It wouldn't make any sense to suppose he was. Descartes is a bundle theorist simply in the sense that he thinks once we've analyzed the substance into its principal attribute, that basic property of which all the other properties are modifications, so for mind, thought, for body's extension, and into all of its particular modifications, the thoughts I'm having now or the particular shape of the wine glass, once we've done that, we've exhausted everything there is there. Now, so some people think the principal attribute for Descartes serves in a kind of analogous role to prime matter for Aristotelians who have prime matter or the substratum from Locke. Yeah, there might be something to be said for that. But insofar as it's counted as a property, there are only properties. Descartes puts this in one of his letters. He says the substance just is the sum of the attributes or something along those lines.
Okay. So that makes more sense. I'm so glad that you helped me distinguish that from Hume, because that is the direction I was going. So this is super helpful. And I understand now why Descartes would do that, especially with the role that thinking plays in his philosophy. I wonder about individuation, your thinking versus my thinking. It seems, I used to think that substratum was nuts and Hexades were nuts, and then J.P. Moreland kind of got me over on that side through one of his classes. And now I'm like, well, isn't my thinking like what if thinking is the property that is essential to my immaterial aspect, and you're also thinking, how are we individuated if my thinking isn't like a Hexade or a something completely, different than yours?
Yeah. This is a question in which I'm extremely interested. I don't address it in the book at all, so far as I can recall. I think the arguments in the book kind of go through without trying to deal with this.
Sure.
But I'm really interested in it. And I came to a kind of crazy view on this question, or maybe like really, really sensible view, according to which I'm inclined to say something like this. The one mistake, it seems to me, in much of the history of philosophy is to suppose that abstract entities, which is to say entities that aren't instantiated either in space or in time, in the causal order of the world, like numbers according to many people, Platonists and so on. It's often supposed that abstract entities are all universal. They're things like redness or justice or circularity. It seems to me actually that abstract entities ought to be regarded as including particulars. So there is that abstract entity which is the possibly actualizable essence of Parker Dedekes, and likewise Ralph Stefan Weir, and likewise David Hume, and so on. And I'm also inclined to say that the abstract concrete distinctions should just be collapsed into the possible actual distinction. I think when we talk about something being possible and actual, we really mean possibly concrete versus actually concrete. Now, one day I'm going to write this really great book where I set out all of this. So it's slightly to my annoyance, having arrived at this view, I realized that the great, sadly deceased philosopher of religion, David Urquhart, had a very similar view, and that actually the great metaphysician and epistemologist Timothy Williamson has a very similar view. His view that all things necessarily exist is essentially the same idea as I think I'm getting at. So that's some like kind of complicated, maybe not that interesting background. The short answer is yeah. And I think these, you know, abstract essences that can be concretely actualized serve something like the role of scotuses, hyxaetes. I think we are intuitive hyxaetes. I think it's really hard to get away from something that looks a bit like hyxaetism. The fact that it's this very one does not seem to me to be analyzable in more fundamental terms, and it doesn't seem to be eliminable from a plausible conception of reality.
Yeah, that's good. Well, so is that what we are? Like, because you can, I feel like I can take away, I don't know, you could, you know, some kind of metaphysical physician, doctor with a scalpel could, you know, remove this property and that property from me. But if they took away my hexaity from me, it's like, that's where it gets like contradiction in terms. I don't know that. So that I would say like, that's what I am, but that, what is that thing? If it has no properties, how is that me? You know, it's so tough to think.
I mean, I'm inclined to say that, what you are is, of course, a concrete entity instantiated in time and at least contingently in space as well. And it may be that part of your hyxaity, your essence, is that you can only concretely exist if you also have some other properties. So it's the one that makes you you. But we only arrive at the idea of it by abstracting away properties without which it could not really be instantiated. I'd be skeptical that one's hyxaity could be instantiated by itself. Therefore, I guess I'd say one's hyxaity is a property and not a substance.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I like that. I think of maybe this won't work for you, but like in The Sims, there's like this green thing that hovers over you.
Yeah.
I think that's, that in my head, that's just what came to mind. Yeah, we all have a little diamond over our head. That's the hexaity. It's like a property saying that we do exist concretely, perhaps. This all is super fascinating for me when it comes to questions of like existing in God's mind, or God having the idea of you in mind prior to making it concrete, or, you know, these ideas of Molinism stuff. So I just want to flag that for the audience that this is really cool stuff for a lot of different philosophy of religion type stuff as well. Man, I caught your cough. Now I'm coughing here too.
It's amazing that these videos can do that now.
Yeah. They're getting so advanced, so high tech. I did want to talk again, this doesn't fit a whole ton. It's for me. And I really, something I've been thinking about a lot because I've been doing some work on artificial intelligence, and you brought up this distinction between a functional or phenomenal consciousness and functional consciousness. Yeah. And I think I side with you on your understanding of functional consciousness. Can you broach, like, a lot of us will know what phenomenal is, right? Is what it's like to be a bat. I've talked about this a lot, but the functional one I think is really helpful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a distinction that's very helpfully set out by David Chalmers in his classic, I think it's 1995 paper, Facing Up to the Problem of Consciousness. By functional consciousness, we mean responding for something to respond to its environment in a way that takes account of the stimuli present around it. And there are lots of specific ways in which human beings are functionally conscious. So, for example, if we can see that there's some delicious food across the room, we might go over and eat it. That's responding to our environment in a sensible way. we see there's a saber-toothed tiger coming to attack us. Some of us will run and others of us will try to strangle it or something. This is all, you know, it's responding to stimuli in your environment. And very often in our neuroscience and adjacent disciplines, it's really valuable, useful, and interesting to try and put forward a theory of how these functionally conscious processes are accomplished. There's been some, like, really fascinating stuff on even simple things like things we might foolishly regard as simple, like vision. You know, you intuitively think that your visual apparatus just give you a window onto the world. No, in fact, it involves all of this kind of quasi-theoretical stuff, predictive processing and so on. So that's a really interesting area for neuroscientists. However, insofar as we're interested in the mind-body problem, functional consciousness is not a serious issue. I think I say it in the book that, like, to be functionally conscious does not involve anything mental any more than the behavior of an automatic door.
I love that.
It's responding to the environment. And I think that therefore the term conscious here is a bit of a misnomer insofar as it's supposed to signify some kind of mental state. I'm inclined to say it gets applied because we're well aware in human beings, the functionally conscious processes are typically also phenomenally conscious. But really, these are just two different topics, both very interesting, but not to be confused with one another. There are, of course, materialists like Daniel Dennett who wants to argue really there only is functional consciousness. Really, the idea that there's this other kind is some kind of illusion or persistent theoretical error. But they themselves are aware that in saying that, they are making a controversial and at face value counterintuitive claim.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was so helpful because that brings us to just a distinction that you made between types of materialists, a casual materialist and an informed materialist. And I think of like a Roomba. You talked about automatic doors, which is even better, but we say a Roomba, we act like it is a thing, you know, depending on your mereology, it may not even be a thing, but we act like it's this thing that is functionally conscious. And we kind of use that terminology, and a lot of us have let people use that terminology, and then they turn back around, like in the Dennett fashion, and go, "Oh, so you too, and me too, and all of us." And it's like, well, no, this was we let you use this terminology in order to say something interesting about artifacts, but then don't come back and make me into an artifact, because obviously, if you present all sorts of arguments that I'm not conscious, I can't believe those. I'm just not able to follow you on that. Right. So I thought that was really fascinating. The distinction between a casual materialist and an informed materialist, I thought was super helpful. The casual ones are like, hey, look, someone who does work on philosophy of mind and neuroscience and cognitive science and all that stuff, they know, they've got the information that can show us how to solve the hard problem of consciousness or something. And the informed ones, you said, take one of two stances. One is, they deny consciousness exists, or they explain that it's just physical. So the informed ones tell you why there's not an answer to the hard problem, and the uninformed
they don't explain it. Well, they don't just say it's just physical. They say it's just physical, but we have no idea how. Informed.
Yeah, but and something that's important there is that they. And I've had this happen on my show with my friends who are physicalists, and I love you guys, but they'll say, like, we haven't given enough time. Like, why? One of them, my friend, I won't say his name, but he was like, well, I think punting to substance dualism is too quick. We haven't been at this that long. And it's like, well, I don't know. If you trace this back to Plato, then it has been kind of long. So I thought that was a really helpful distinction that you made.
Yeah. I mean, I find it, you know, I think it's sort of sociologically true. I guess if I'm writing the book, I'm more and more interested in, like, where all this sits in our wider intellectual culture. Mm-hmm. That I'm very interested in the, you know, rigorous analytical arguments about specific details. But those become vastly more interesting when you think about where it fits into wider intellectual culture. And this is a distinction I kind of noticed, but you can't really write about that kind of stuff in philosophy journals. So that opening chapter of a book's a really good opportunity to say, well, look, here's what I really think is going on. And yeah, I've met many, many people who take it for granted that there are some experts in neuroscience or philosophy who have worked out and understood why it is that certain arrangements of physical particles and or forces and fields must be conscious. And a nice thing about having a thriving philosophical culture is that, you know, there are plenty of materialists who are well aware that's not true and who look ingenious strategies for explaining why it's not true. I think interestingly, like the "we need to wait longer" attitude, which you mentioned, we'll crack it at some point. I don't see that so frequently among professional academic philosophers who endorse materialism. Maybe this is just anecdotal data, but my impression is that the academic philosophers who've spent a good sort of 10 years trying to work out what scope is there for giving that satisfactory aha explanation, now I see why it must be the case, have generally accepted we're not going to get that. Like, if there were any scope for that, the Mary argument, the zombies argument, and so on, just would not get off the ground. The fact that they do shows the kind of explanation a materialist will give is going to have to be one that accounts for the fact that we cannot see why any physical system should have to be conscious, at least unless we adopt the panpsychist move of saying that the actually underlying these observable physical properties is a bunch of mental stuff. Some of the people who say we've just got to wait, maybe they're sort of not really distinguishing between that and materialism proper. In the book, of course, I argue that panpsychists inevitably end up, if they're not materialists, being dualists or idealists. And I think they have to be substance dualists or idealists. So there's not really a third way there.
I loved that part because I had thought that for so long, and I thought maybe I just am not getting panpsychism because these panpsychists keep saying that there's a third way. And I'm like, well, I just don't see how you're not like a property dualist. And if you're a property dualist, then why not go, full bore? So then seeing you say that, I was like, okay, I'm not as crazy, or maybe we're both just crazy together, but you were there first. So that's good.
I've been trying for years to get Philip Goff to admit he has to be a substance idealist. And I feel like I'm getting closer and closer. But
I love that. I asked him last time he was on the podcast about that, because I don't see him. And maybe he's like, head and shoulders above, and he's living in the year 4,000, but I'm still trying to figure it out.
He is. I mean, in my opinion, he's one of the great minds of our age, and it's a huge honor to get to occasionally chat with him about this stuff. But he is completely wrong about that particular issue.
It's good. I'm so glad. Yeah, that's great. I hope that he listens to this. I think he probably will. Okay, so I going back to Descartes and the bundle theory view and taking away your thinking, I guess. I wonder, do you think that a weird criticism of Descartes is that, like, I think therefore I am. So when you're not thinking, you don't exist, right? And it's like kind of, it's like the first year philosophy student is like, aha, I've busted you, or I stink, therefore I am. And it's like, well, no, not quite. You can't do that. But now going back and thinking through it more deeply in the bundle view, I'm wondering, I wonder if it's true. You know, can you have a non-conscious mind? I know that there's good ways to argue around this. Someone says, well, what about when you go into a dreamless sleep? And someone might say, well, maybe since your brain isn't activated, you are conscious, but you're not encoding that information in memories. So there's different sophisticated ways to get around that. But I wonder, could you have a non-conscious mind?
Yeah, this is another of these like extremely interesting questions, which I haven't yet worked on seriously. No, it's great to touch on. I mean, when I was working with Stephen Priest, he would always say, don't bother about refuting the dominant position, write to the new paradigm, write, fill in the detail, put forward a plausible picture. That's much more exciting. And I haven't quite done that yet, but the next book, maybe I'll try.
Yeah.
And this is one of the questions that really has to be addressed. I am actually, I'm sympathetic to the idea that I do not concretely exist if I am not undergoing conscious experience. At least I don't want to rule out that idea. Yeah. I'm not sure that that entails that there are gaps in a person's experience when they're unconscious. This depends partly on what relationship we think obtains between phenomenological time and physical time. Right at the end of Philip Goff's book, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, it's a really interesting, promising sort of section where he talks about how phenomenal transparency, this principle he uses to generate his view, might entail that we have access to the fundamental nature of time and experience, and it would be useful for the wider metaphysics. That's going to be relevant here. I can't remember where it is, but I once read this essay by another great contemporary philosopher, Howard Robinson, where I think he argued for a view according to which you do not exist when you're not conscious, and then addressed this concern that there are these discontinuities in your experience, if that's so. I'd add some caveats, though. Like, if it's the case that you don't exist when you're not conscious, it only means you don't exist concretely. You still exist in the sense that me and Williamson and David Erfitt think exist necessarily. And furthermore, from the perspective of other conscious persons, you might well still have interests, commitments, and so on that do depend on your simultaneous conscious experience, such that some of the conclusions we'd expect to follow from your not existing, like, oh, well, we don't have to care about the guy. He's not here now. Or, it's all over there. You know, that's not going to follow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you're like blowing my mind here. That's such cool stuff to think through. And I wonder for the audience who's like, why did you even bring that up? I'm wondering about like the artificial intelligence conversation where people refer to them as having minds, but of course they don't have phenomenal consciousness yet. And it's like, well, okay, so you're committed to this idea that you can have a mind without phenomenal consciousness, but you know, the phenomenologists are probably tearing their hair out right now. And so just bringing that into a fuller conversation of saying why this, what may look like just pure raw speculation, and maybe it is still, has practical import for, you know, public philosophy and for computer science conversations where people throw this stuff around just super willy-nilly and trigger me all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very interested in, I think the recent developments in AI have caught many scientific thinkers off their guard because, you know, part of being a bit skeptical of contemporary scientific intellectual culture is to be a bit skeptical of some of the radical predictions that are made about the future of technology. And I think we should hand it to a bit of them, like GPT-4 and Stable Diffusion and so on. These are really amazing. And, you know, it's going to be difficult to work out how to demarcate what we think are obviously conscious beings and what we think we have to, for the sake of to avoid making mistake, treat as though they might be conscious beings. Now, insofar as people are saying, well, these AIs are conscious but not phenomenally conscious, I think, well, the answer is they're saying they're functionally conscious, and that's absolutely fine. Functional consciousness has no particularly important normative or metaphysical implications. The fact it's functionally conscious doesn't mean you have to give it rights, you have to treat it kindly or anything. I mean, I think we should treat ChatGPT kindly just because we shouldn't habituate ourselves to being unkind to something that behaves a bit like a conscious being, but only for that reason.
Yeah.
I do think there's a real question about although I'm inclined to see the conscious mind as something fundamental and distinct from, and I'm inclined to say more fundamental than the physical world, which I'm inclined to say is, you know, a model generated by out of the contents of conscious experiences and not actually a fundamental description of reality. Even so, I'm sympathetic to the idea that it may be that certain arrangements of matter correlate necessarily with or causally bring about the existence of conscious experience, mm-hmm. right? I kind of think that if you get a sperm and an egg together, they'll develop in a certain way that will result in a conscious mind. And, you know, we're confident that there's a correlation there. We're not quite sure why it happens. Therefore, it doesn't seem to me, even if you're an idealist or a substance dualist, that you can wash your hands of the worry, well, what about when computer programs get sufficiently sophisticated that they can mimic the behavior of conscious beings? What good grounds do we have to say they're not conscious? Now, I don't think we'll have the same grounds to say they are conscious as other human beings, because we know other human beings and other sentient animals develop out of the same evolutionary tree, the same massive biological history that we did. And that gives us extra reason to suppose it'd be pretty weird if I were the only conscious one, probably if I had the others are too. But nonetheless, I think there's a really serious problem there. And I'm actually occasionally it worries me. I think I'm not sure we're going to really know what to do about it when we have AIs that are more or less indistinguishable from conscious beings. I also think, well, one other thing that interests me here is transhumanism, the idea that maybe we could upload our minds onto computers. And I'm writing, like, I got invited to a transhumanist conference once and wrote a paper on it. And then since then, I keep on finding myself having to write papers about transhumanism for various issues and things. I'm writing like the fourth or fifth now. And I do think, irrespective of whether artificial intelligence can be phenomenally conscious, I do think we have very good reason to be skeptical of the idea that we could live indefinitely by uploading our minds onto computers. There's a sort of complicated argument for that, but in short, I think the reason for wanting to upload your mind presupposes that personal identity is this very fundamental, important thing that we should value, the kind of thing that seems to entail a soul, and perhaps a heightened deity is kind of a nucleus of that soul. But if that's the case, then there's really no reason to suppose that scanning and destroying your brain and implementing the same computational processes, if the brain is computational, in a computer is going to result in you waking up with a computer for a brain. Whereas what transhumanists often say is, well, look, we adopt the Parfitian view of personal identity. It's really just a matter of these patterns, these continuities of causation and resemblance. Well, if that's the case, then yeah, sure, scan and destroy your brain, upload the computational processes on a computer. That if there's a person who wakes up with a computer for their brain, they are the most continuous person with you, and therefore we can call them you, we can count them as being the same person as you, but only because on that revisionary Parfitian view of personal identity, to say that something is the same person as some earlier individual is merely a manner of speaking that tracks certain continuities. And as Parfit himself points out, not something that you could rationally care about, not something that could satisfy your desire to survive and go on living. Sorry, that was a mini lecture in response to your question.
That was fantastic. You touched on so many things that I've been thinking about. I've seen, again, this is probably, you know, an empirical thing. It is, but maybe it's anecdotal. But when I talk with the folks on the tech side of things, they'll often be very optimistic about mind uploads because they want to continue living. And they think, like, you know, death is bad, and they have their own eschatology in a tech space. It's fascinating, actually. But then when pressed, they do go back to like Derek Parfitian structuralist view or patternist view of mind. And you go, well, wait, that's not actually you. And they go, oh yeah, no, it's not actually me. It's like, but your whole impetus here was that you wanted to continue living. And then when I press you on it, you're not actually living. And actually you're not living now. It's just the pattern. And you are a strange loop. And, you know, it's really fascinating and fun to have this
kind of a bait and switch, I think. When they're pitching the idea, they say it's really you. But when they're justifying the technology, they say, nah, it's not really you.
That's right, right. Yeah. And so I like to be the gadfly there and poke at them. Just like I invite them to poke at me as well. When it comes to that conversation of existing without mental property or without thinking, the property of thinking, I guess. I wonder, I want to get back to your work in the book, because I've taken you down all these rabbit trails, and you've been so gracious to follow me there. But in the book, you give a parody of reasoning argument. You know, if you go in for philosophical zombies, then you should go in for phenomenal souls. What's the terminology you use?
There? Phenomenal substances, I guess I'd say. Yeah. I don't remember. Oh, I haven't read it in ages.
Yeah, that's great. So, if you go in for Phil zombies, then you should be on the hook for ghosts or, you know, phenomenological
material style. Yeah.
Yeah. And the ghost language at first, I was like, oh no, don't do this. Then I saw it was from Phil Goff. And, oh, well, if Goff did it, then we can get away with it. So yeah, you can go in for immaterial souls, and then if immaterial souls, then substance dualism. But I wonder or idealism. Are philosophical zombies conceivable on a Cartesian picture of the substance and you know, existing as a bundle of properties, including that most important one for your immaterial aspect of thinking?
Well, so the idea of a philosophical zombie is the idea of an exact physical duplicate of you, except that it's all dark on the inside. That has no conscious experience. You know, a puppet is a loose approximation of a philosophical zombie. And clever animatronics is a closer approximation. And I'm strongly inclined to the view that we can make sense of the idea of a precise philosophical zombie, a being where all the physical particles and fields move about in exactly the same way as they do in the life of a conscious human being, except that this being isn't conscious. It just seems to be, just as a puppet or some animatronics might. Now, I would say the idea, there is a complication here. So if like David Chalmers, who really did the most to popularize the idea, or that appears earlier than him, if like Chalmers, you're assuming that conscious experience, if there's an immaterial mind of any kind or immaterial phenomenal properties, does not act causally on the body, so it doesn't make any difference to what a human being does, then for a philosophical zombie to exist would not require any change in the causal laws that govern the world.
Mm.
Whereas if, like me or various other contemporary proponents of the soul idea, Richard Swinburne or Joshua Farris or Benedict Gurker, I would guess Martina Niederrümelin and all sorts of others. If you think, actually, no, the conscious mind, not only is it immaterial, but it acts causally on the body.
Yeah.
Well, then a world just like ours without your conscious mind would be one in which your body would probably suddenly slump down, or it wouldn't behave intelligently. There's a sense in which a philosophical zombie is not what you would get by just removing consciousness. However, I think the idea remains useful, because we can say, well, look, okay, to be sure, but we can imagine a world in which the causal laws are adjusted so that the matter still does exactly what it does in this world without any conscious experience. Is that a coherent idea? And it seems to me that is clearly a coherent idea. There's nothing in the idea of these particles and fields moving about in the way they do that entails logically or conceptually that there's anything it's like to be the thing composed of them.
Hmm. Okay.
But okay.
So, I always struggle with this, and that's my problem, because I entered into philosophy through like the argument from reason type stuff, and I was so like gung ho about like the mental causation and how important it is and how you wouldn't have it without it, and against. So I was worried about
by the argument from reason. What are you alluding to?
Well, it's like a family of arguments, right? But C.S. Lewis's one of them.
I was wondering about that. Yeah.
And then maybe like a transcendental type argument. I'm trying to think of the paper, but the transcendental refutation of determinism, type stuff. It's a still Hasker's paper. And, you know, it's still within the realm of the argument for reason. So I'm always nervous to give any ground on that, because I think, if I say that there's a world where it's possible that a purely material being is responding to reasons while not having a material, an immaterial component to them, then am I just conceding the argument against the argument from reason? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I guess I see the worry, although I'm pretty confident. So I'm very sympathetic to both the argument from reason and maybe slightly lesser degree to the transcendental arguments for free will. However, I don't see them as incompatible with the zombie arguments. It seems to me to accept the zombie argument is only to accept that a being could behave as though it were responding to reasons, okay. As though it thought itself free in a world where really there's just matter bouncing around, just as a puppet can do so in a puppet shape. Whereas the crucial thing about the argument from reason is that we do actually, one premise is we really do think we're responding to reason, and we can't rationally conclude that we're not. So any theory of the world motivated by reasoning that entails we're not responsive to reasons must be incoherent. So I think the two are compatible. Maybe there's room there for maybe someone needs to write an essay addressing that point head on and discussing, is there a tension between these two lines of reasoning or not?
That's great. Yeah, I love that. That sounds fantastic. So so then getting on to your parody of reasoning argument, why think that if you go in for philosophical zombies, you should likewise go in for phenomenological disembodied substance?
Yeah. Well, if in the book there is there's a lot of sort of background work and a lot of, at least the start, sort of big picture, here's how I see it all fitting together stuff. But if there's a hard, round, analytical point in the book, it's this, which is that proponents of property dualism who are motivated by the zombie argument, who think, we can coherently imagine a physical duplicate of a world with no consciousness, therefore such a world is possible, therefore consciousness is something extra. They standardly conclude there are non-physical properties, but reject non-physical substances. They do not take the time typically to specify what exactly the property substance distinction consists in. Now, I take the view that once you do that, once you investigate, what does this distinction consist in, or what is the relevant distinction here? And you realize it is the distinction between things that can and can't exist by themselves. That is to say, a modal distinction. A substance is something that does not necessitate the existence of other things. Then it becomes swiftly apparent that the line of reasoning put forward in favor of property dualism can simply be inverted to give us an argument in favor of substance dualism. The argument for property dualism says the physical facts don't a priori entail, they don't logically entail the existence of physical things, of phenomenal, of conscious experience rather. Therefore, the physical facts don't necessitate the existence of consciousness. There could be a physical world like ours without consciousness. Well, if you invert that argument, you have an argument that says the phenomenal facts, the facts about our phenomenal experience, do not logically entail the existence of anything physical. That's something that most property journalists explicitly accept. David Chalmers, Philip Goff, who I count as a panpsychist, a property journalist, and so on. Premise two, if the phenomenal facts don't logically entail the existence of anything physical, then they don't necessitate the existence of anything physical. Well, then it just follows there is at least one phenomenal entity whose existence does not require, does not necessitate the existence of anything physical. So there's at least one non-physical substance. And then you can adjust the argument a bit and say, well, what about the phenomenal facts about my own experience, excluding other people? Do they entail the existence of anything physical or the existence of any other minds? Maybe leaving aside God. And you get the conclusion that I'm a non-physical substance. And I think this argument's important because unlike other arguments for a non-physical self or soul, this one, at least I contend, only uses premises to which property dualists are themselves explicitly committed.
Yeah.
So it's not like they can say, oh, yeah, sure, that's an interesting argument, but I'm not sure about it. As a matter of consistency, or as I put it in the book, by parity of reasoning, if they're going to accept the zombie argument for property dualism, they need to accept this phenomenal disembodiment argument for substance dualism.
Hmm.
It's not very unlike Descartes' disembodiment argument or Swinburne's disembodiment argument. But those arguments make use of the first person personal pronoun I, which brings in a whole load of complex issues, which allows property dualists what I and Swinburne and Descartes think is a spurious way out, but nonetheless, at least a way out that allows them to seem to be consistent.
Yeah, I like this. I like this, that it goes just to some immaterial substance and then to the I, which I thought was really fantastic. I wonder, not to jump off it too quick, but something else you bring up in the book about liberal Platonism, that these are Platonists who, strong, you know, realist Platonists, whatever, Platonists who believe in uninstantiated forms, but, you know, properties as well. Like there are free-floating properties somewhere in Plato's heaven. I think I count myself as one of those, and I'm wondering if I can still appropriate your arguments even while thinking that there are, in fact, properties that are uninstantiated.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think liberal Platonism is true. So yeah. I hope I can appropriate my argument. So just to explain this issue, I mentioned earlier one thing that I think has kind of scared people off from seriously looking into the metaphysics of properties and substances as a precursor to clarifying our responses to the mind-body problem, is that there's this big thing called the problem of universals. Like, what is the relationship between the universal property of redness and an individual red pillar box, for example? And something strange happened in the 20th century. I think Quine, Willard Van Orman Quine, is largely to blame, which is that people start taking the view that either you're allowed to say there are abstract universal properties. There is redness itself, as Plato would say, in some kind of Platonic heaven or in the same world as mathematical objects like numbers, that are instantiated by objects, by what I would call substances, like a wine glass, instantiate the shape of the wine glass, that kind of thing. Or you're allowed to say, actually, there are concrete, particular property instances, like the particular shape of this very wine glass, which I am experiencing now, which is having a causal impact on my sensory field. Whereas, in fact, for the whole history of philosophy, as far as I can tell, most people endorse both of those views. There are abstract, universal properties, like redness, and there are concrete property instances that belong to individual concrete substances. So I think that's the view Plato held. I think it's the view that most of the medieval philosophers held. And I think it's the most plausible view, liberal Platonism.
Yeah, that's great. Well, so, that's so good. I wonder, you know, like David Armstrong and maybe Aristotle would say, like, there's no uninstantiated forms, what Aristotle, I believe, would say, but I think bringing that up to date to properties as well, like, there's the whole critique of the blue museum. You put everything blue inside a museum and you paint it blue and then you blow it up. And it's like, is there no more blue?
Yeah,
it seems like it's still blue. So that is really helpful. I'm glad that you don't need to be that type of property theorist in order to motivate this argument. I wonder about the definition of substance there. I've studied under guys like Paul Gould, who have like a really specific definition of substance with, you know, properties and parts and powers. And then you look at folks like Swinburne, who are like, well, substance is just a thing. And then you get Descartes, and Descartes is like something it's this independence definition or thesis. You cash that out in a metaphysical and in a causal interpretation of the independence definition. Do you have that on top of your mind? I know it's kind of like I know it could be really in depth. Can you help us with that? Like, how should we think about independence and substance?
Yeah. And so, I have an academic article that I think is like as readable as these things get, in the review of metaphysics called, Bring Back Substances! Where I go into this in greater detail than in the book. The term has been used in a multiple different ways increasingly in recent philosophy. And that was not always the case. I think that for the first sort of 2000-ish years of Western philosophy, maybe like 2,200 years, basically people accepted Aristotle's definition in the categories, where he says a substance is something in which properties belong or to which predicates are applied, that does not belong to anything else in the same way and that is not said of other things in the same way. That's slightly ambiguous, but it's a pretty helpful definition. Then things change when Descartes comes out with his independence definition, which in my opinion just very slightly clarifies Aristotle's definition. So Aristotle says quite clearly that our properties or attributes, they can't exist by themselves. They have to exist in a substance. He doesn't explicitly say a substance can exist by itself. That may be taken as implied. Many people think it is implied, but he doesn't explicitly say it. And Descartes adds this one thing. He says, yeah, a substance can exist by itself. And Descartes' ideas are taken up by Antoine Arnauld and Pierre Nicole in the Port-Royal Logic, which unfortunately people don't really read today. I recommend it. I think it's a great book, despite all the Jansenism. And
I was going to say, that's the only reason I knew about it. I wrote a paper on Pascal being a Jansenist. And
Pascal was one of these guys too. In that book, they popularized Cartesianism and this new conception of the basics of philosophy becomes dominant, including Descartes' conception of substance. But before the Port-Royal Logic, Aristotle's Categories was the first book everyone engaging in higher education in the whole post-Roman world, including Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, it was the first text they read for at least like 1300, maybe as much as sort of 1700 years. And then after the Port-Royal Logic, that sort of took the place of Aristotle's Categories and the rest of the Organon. So I think there's a lot of precedent to the idea that that there's a pretty standard meaning to be given to the term substance in philosophy, which just means something that can exist by itself. I want to revive that conception of substance. I think it's been wrongly dismissed, even by Richard Swinburne, for this idea that something that could exist by itself would have to be able to exist without its properties, and that makes no sense. Well, my reply to that is, that's not what the phrase by itself means. When I say that the wine glass is on the table by itself, I don't mean it's there without any of its properties. I mean, it, including its properties, is there, but there's nothing further. We have this intuitive notion of what's included in anything and what's not included in it. When something by itself, it's there with the things included in it. Sorry, two months.
Well, I wonder about like the essential. Do you need to make a distinction between essential and non-essential properties in order to have this by itselfness?
Well, I think in the ordinary sense of the term, if I say the wine glass is by itself on the table, it's no refutation of my claim that it has some accidental properties.
Yeah.
So, at the moment, the wine glass has the deplorable accidental property of being largely empty, but it's not. Maybe you'd say the wine isn't part of the wine glass, but you get what I mean. I don't think.
Kool-Aid man. Yeah, the Kool-Aid man. Is the Kool-Aid man the Kool-Aid plus the shaper? Yeah, that's great.
No, that's a really deep question. Yeah, we can't resolve that one tonight.
Right.
I think it's so. I'm having said all that in favor of this traditional definition of substance, I would add, it seems to me, in the context of a mind-body problem, that's probably the really important definition. Mm-hmm. And it's just it's perfectly consistent with that. But in other contexts, we might want to develop other conceptions of substance which are in some way derivative from or related to this traditional conception and are useful in other areas.
Yeah.
And I do think it's right when Swinburne says it just means a thing. Well, I think he's incorrect to say that the independence definition that I defend is incoherent. But I think he's right that that definition probably does enter philosophy as an attempt to capture our more inchoate, intuitive notion of a thing as opposed to a property of a thing.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's totally legitimate to look for other ways to cash out that intuitive distinction and to claim what one is doing is clarifying the concept of substance. Howard Robinson and I are meant to be writing a new version of a Stanford Encyclopedia article on substance, which we're meant to submit the new draft about 3 weeks ago. once that's out, this will all be completely.
Okay, that's great. I look forward to that. So the reason that I thought about liberal Platonism being incompatible with the arguments is because this idea that properties cannot exist by themselves, but maybe I'm confused. Maybe I'm thinking maybe it's property instances or property exemplifications to include both. Yeah. Okay. To include both the Aristotelian and the Platonist, I'll say exemplification instances. So it's those that can't exist by themselves.
That's exactly the view. I mean, this is one of these irritating details one has to go into and try to say what one thinks about these things. And such property distinction as a distinction between things that can and can't exist by themselves works very well when thinking about the concrete world, which is the cool term philosophy used to mean the world of things instantiated in space or time and that act causally on one another. I think these definitions should be just thought of as ranging over things in that world. If it can exist by itself in the sense of without other concrete things, then it's a substance. If not, it's a property, a concrete property. But if, like me, you also think there's an abstract world involving numbers and universals and hexaetic essences of things and so on, well, I would think all of those on a ordinary Platonist view exist necessarily. That none of those can exist without any of the others, and nothing concrete can exist without any of them. Mm. So the can exist by itself or not distinction ceases to be useful when we're talking about the abstract platonic heaven, if there is not.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I also go in for theistic conceptual realism. So I guess I don't think those things exist on their own anyways, because I want to ground those in the mind of God. So that's fun. This is so good. I love this.
I'm sympathetic to that view too, in fact. It's not something I've investigated in detail. And I've occasionally tried to work out, like, when does that view enter the history of philosophy? And I never managed. So if you can give me some references, I know, like, by the end of Middle Ages, it's sort of presupposed by a lot of people.
Yeah.
In late antiquity, you don't see much sign of it. Maybe in the Neoplatonist, but I've never found anything like a really explicit locus classicus where this view enters.
Yeah. Well, so Greg Welty has done his dissertation on this under Swinburne. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not. No.
Yeah. I'll send some stuff when we're off there.
I'd really appreciate it.
And he and James Anderson have written a piece on it, and they claim it's souped up Augustine. Some people say. I heard one commentator said it was warmed over Berkeley or something, and they go, no, souped up Augustine. So, yeah, we could talk more about that. So this book is awesome. We just kind of scratched the surface, and there's so many really clear and concise, good arguments here. I love it, man. Thanks so much for sending it to me. And just from talking with you, we have so many like similar interests, and you're just further down the line. So I think you can really help me with a lot of stuff. So I would love to have you back on to talk. We could talk all sorts of stuff, but this has been one of the most stimulating conversations I've had in a long time. So thank you so much for coming on to share your work.
I've enjoyed it immensely. Thank you so much for having me on. And yeah, I'd love to come back and to talk more.
Yeah.
And to try and make people buy my book.
That's right. That's right. Well, Ralph, where can people find some of your work if they're more interested in other ideas you have?
There's a couple of videos on YouTube. There's one called In Defense of the Soul, which was a talk I gave a little under a year ago at PUC House in Oxford, which gives kind of the same topic as the first chapter of the book. And it's my effort at being really accessible and getting across why this stuff is important. So if people are interested, I hope they might find that worth viewing. And there's one or two other videos. There's one about why there's something rather than nothing on, I think that's actually on Facebook, on the Lincoln Philosophy Salon page. And then, if you go to my faculty page at Lincoln, you'll find a bunch of academic articles, which, I try when I write to make it clear and enjoyable to read, because I hate reading boring stuff. And so it's like, I would kind of hope that if you're interested in this stuff and you don't understand or enjoy what I'm writing, then it's clearly my fault and I've failed in what I'm trying to do. So I guess I'd direct people towards that. In the future, I really want to try and write some more stuff, more public facing stuff. I have a few things in the works, sort of shorter pieces, op-ed kind of things. And, once I tell, the New York Times that I featured on Parker's Pensées, then they're definitely going to say, well, okay, we've got to publish you.
That's great. That's awesome. That's so great. All right. Well, so folks, again, it's a Routledge Studies in Contemporary Philosophy book, The Mind, Body, Problem, and Metaphysics, An Argument from Consciousness to Mental Substance by Ralph Stephan Weir. I got it because I'm awesome and I have a podcast. I think it's probably going to be kind of expensive. So if that's the case, ask your libraries to order it, and then you can get you can get it for free. So go and
there will be a paperback soon too.
Can't wait. I love that. Yeah. They do that. I know they always do that. And it's so tough because the author's like, you guys don't, it's not like you guys are making a bunch of money. It's like they're selling it to the libraries first. So that's wild. All right, folks. Well, that's going to have to do it for now. This has been Parker's Pensées. And as always, all glory to God.